This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Even if you don't think you know the band Eels, you might know their music from the soundtracks of Shrek, American Beauty, 6 Feet Under, Grey's Anatomy, and other TV shows and movies. The Eels song Fresh Blood was the theme for the HBO series The Jinx about suspected serial killer Robert Durst. My guest, Mark Oliver Everett, is the founder and creative force behind Eels. He's written many songs about depression, his and other people's. One of the first songs he became known for was titled Novocaine for the Soul. The song Elizabeth on the Bathroom Floor is about one of the times his sister tried to kill herself. Everett was close with his sister, but hardly knew his father, Hugh Everett, who was a physicist specializing in quantum mechanics. 60 years ago, he originated the theory of parallel universes. He was dismissed as a kook during his lifetime, but now he's considered a genius. There's a lot to talk about, but let's start with the title track of the new Eels album, The Deconstruction. It's Everett's first album after a 4-year hiatus. Mark Oliver Everett, or E, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's start with the song we just heard. It's a song about falling apart and then putting yourself back together. Is this a description at all of your 4-year hiatus that you recently returned from? 4 years hiatus from performing and recording?
Yes, I've been on a pretty long project of self-improvement in general for a while. I'll actually take notes on how could I have done that differently? How could this be better? You know, that kind of thing over the years. And 4 years ago, I got to the point where, you know, if you do any one thing too much in your life, it catches up to you and makes it clear that you need to do something else. And for me, that was working. And I'd gotten to the point where I suddenly, it somehow had been 25 years of just constant, intense work. And, you know, it was particularly complicated in my case because music really did save me in so many ways. And so I, you know, tried to thank it by giving it all my attention. But, of course, if your life is too unbalanced, it becomes a problem in other areas of your life. And I didn't have any other areas of my life, really. That was the problem. So I just kind of set out to really take a break from working and try to pay attention to all the other sides. And the idea of the deconstruction to me is, you know, we spend most of our lives after we're born slowly building up these defenses and walls around ourselves. And I just thought, well, what's underneath all that? What would happen if you tore down those defenses? What do we start with?
Well, how comfortable were you looking at that? Because in part, like, your music seemed to be a way of processing the deaths of people in your family, your sister's suicide, a way of processing it and also maybe standing back a bit and looking at it with some distance, which you have to do when you're making art out of something. So when you take the music away, that also takes away your way of processing really problematic things in life. So
yeah.
What was it like to take that away and then just deal with like life without music as the intermediary?
That's a really good question, because I'm the classic example of like an artist type personality who pours everything into that, and that's how I know how to relate to things. And like it's a very natural process for me to write a song with just absolutely no filter on and really just get down and peel all the different layers of the onion till I get to the heart of the matter. And it's very easy to deal with things in this very intimate way, as long as it's in a song. So yeah, and that's another reason why I had to take a four-year break. Or I was like, oh, what happens if it's not in a song?
So what happened? Did you have more time for friends, for relationships?
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
was this, I mean, was it this big depression-filled void?
No, it started out in just kind of exhaustion and confusion and not really knowing what to do. But I even thought at first, like, I might just be done working for a while. It just felt like that. I just had no desire for it, which was very unusual for me to, you know, finally get to that point. But normal people would have taken some little vacations along the way. And then the people like me who, you know, it's like we do it all or nothing. And then the mistake I think I made was I took that same obsessive energy that I put into all the years of work and said, okay, now I'm going to put all that focus on the other sides of life, and treated it a little too much like a to-do list, you know? So it's still, you know, I'm still in the process of it all. And of course, I guess the process never ends.
So what was on the list? To-do list?
The list of things to do was, you know, get into a relationship and focus on anything but work, and just, you know, quiet, easygoing life, whatever, you know. I mean, it was a bit of a mystery to me. It's like, what is everybody else doing? You know, because I just hadn't come up for air for 25 years.
So did putting get into a relationship on your to-do list help you get into a relationship?
Well, I mean, it wasn't like literally a to-do list at the time, but when I look back on it now, I can see that like I made myself open to that was a priority without really consciously knowing it. And so, yeah, I got married and...
You're married now?
Well, I was.
Oh.
As I said, it's an ongoing process.
So you got married and divorced within the 4 years?
Yeah. Divorced very recently. And with the big surprise that came out of it all was I now have a son. So I'm a first-time father.
Are you surprised to be a father?
I'm very surprised at this point. You know, I'm 54, and it was something at this point I was always open to the idea, but I didn't think at this point it was something that was probably in the cards. And it was a surprise, a wonderful surprise. And it's, you know, particularly an amazing update because I have been operating under the belief that I was the end of my family line, you know, that everyone else had died long ago. And there was always this uncomfortable pressure on my shoulders. And it's like, felt like kind of a failure that I let the family name die when I die, you know, that was the end of it. And that my father, Hugh Everett, the physicist, would, you know, never have a grandchild to carry on the family. And so that part is really poignant and amazing to me. And my son, Archie, is also amazing.
Do you spend time with him? Do you have time to spend with him?
Yeah, yeah.
But you're not, do you live together at all?
Yeah, well, we're splitting. It's a co-parenting mm-hmm, situation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not mm-hmm. how I pictured things, and it's not how I wanted it to go, but I, you know, wasn't given a choice in the matter. So, and that's, if there is any one point to this record that fits right into that, you know, life is constant motion and you have to just go with it. You know, I think I made the mistake of, you know, I had, during that break, I had this one great year that was everything I wanted, that was just calmness and nice times and no drama. And it was naive of me, I think, to expect that to last. And what's happened since then is, I think, more what life really is, you know. I just got lucky with that 1 year, I think. But it's not something you can count on.
So the album to me sounds like an album in which you as the songwriter are trying to convince yourself and somebody else that life is in fact worth living, and that it's that you actually have to make the case for it in the songs.
Yeah, well, I think compassion is a big theme that I see reemerging a lot in it. And, you know, I'm not an expert on any of the subjects in any of these songs. And so often I am speaking to someone in particular in a song, but I'm always simultaneously also speaking to myself. It's always mm-hmm. a note to self, too. I'm always trying to remind mm-hmm. myself the same message.
Let's apply that to a specific song. You have a song, Be Hurt, on the new album, which you're convincing yourself or somebody else that they can handle the pain and survive. Can you talk about
that's definitely a note to self. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
at what point were you emotionally when you wrote this? Like, where were you in the 4-year hiatus that we were discussing?
You know, I don't remember exactly, and I don't know that it was any one particular incident or anything that set that song off, but it was sort of eye-opening to me when I had an epiphany at some point, like, oh, you know, it's not the end of the world to be hurt. And it's, like, very comforting for me to be reminded that it's part of life. And, you know, I should know that by now. It's like, you know, I look at some of the things that I have lived through and survived. But you can lose perspective on that sometimes. You need to be reminded.
Well, let's hear the song. This is Be Hurt, which is written by my guest, Mark Oliver Everett, performed by his band Eels, and from the new album, The Deconstruction.
Be hurt. The world can take it. And so can you. Come on, be hurt. Know that you can take it. And I'm not gonna let it destroy you.
That's Be Hurt from the new Eels album, The Deconstruction. My guest is the founder of Eels, Mark Oliver Everett, also known as E. We'll talk more after a break, and our critic at large, Don Powers, will take another look at 2001 A Space Odyssey on its 50th anniversary. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. Let's get back to my interview with Mark Oliver Everett, founder of the band Eels. The band's new album is called The Deconstruction. So let's talk a little bit about your late family. You did a documentary about your father a few years ago. He was a physicist and expert in quantum mechanics, and he came up with the theory of parallel universes. I once did an interview with Brian Greene about mm-hmm. parallel universes, and in spite of the interview and in spite of trying to read the book, It's a concept that is so just like beyond my comprehension. I can't wrap my brain around it. So what did you learn about your father's theory, and I should mention that when he was alive in the 70s and 80s, I think he was kind of dismissed as a kook, but now he's considered, to have been the inventor of this theory that's taken very seriously now in the world of quantum mechanics.
It's very poignant that his theory is now the prevalent theory. And I just saw something in the news a couple weeks ago that Stephen Hawking just submitted a paper that has something to do with attempting to prove the theory. He thought that that's it,
This is the theory of parallel universes. Is there any way you can explain that briefly in a way that we would understand?
I'm like you. I did not inherit my father's physics genius. Maybe, hopefully, Archie will, but I didn't, And what was great about getting to make that documentary that was on Nova was you get to learn about this through my dumb eyes. I'm the dumb guy who doesn't understand it, and you learn it as I learn it. And, the easiest way where they made me start to understand what it's all about is, they showed me photons that aren't supposed to split, and they actually split. And I watched this with my own eyes, and the physicist who's showing this to me, he's giving me some background on Schrodinger's cat and all that, and then explains, there's just no explanation for this, and that my father's theory was an explanation for it, that there is, something that just seems like magic to us at this point, because it's just so otherworldly, and it's what all the Star Trek episodes and are based on, and Twilight Zones and everything, but that the only explanation for the photon splitting off is the parallel universe theory.
That there's another universe.
That there's countless universes.
Mm-hmm. You write about how you hardly knew your father. He died when you were, 19?
Yeah.
And that he'd hardly talked to you. You say, my father was so uncommunicative that I thought of him the same way I thought of furniture. It was just there.
Yeah. And it was, it never seemed like some negative thing to me. It was just how it was. I was just used to it. He was always a physical presence, but I had very little interaction with him.
Did you know he was brilliant? Did you know he was?
There would be moments as I was growing up where occasionally, I remember the next door neighbor was sitting in his hammock one Saturday afternoon reading a science fiction book, and he came running over and he knocked on the door and he said, "Hugh, you're in this science fiction book." There'd be moments like that where I'd be like, "Huh?" But he didn't live the life of a famous person in any way, so I didn't have any idea. But then, very close to the end of his life, he started to get a little more recognition, where people were starting to say, "Wait a minute, maybe this guy was right." And then after he died, the phone would start ringing, and we'd get these calls from what I called physics groupies that were, he was really starting to catch on right after he died, and people would find my mom's phone number in the phone book and start calling. And it's just kept picking up steam ever since.
Do you think that the theory of parallel universes affected how your father lived his life?
He was 24 when he came up with that, and he was at Princeton. And then I think he probably, if he had gotten a little bit of encouragement, he would have gone on to who knows what next in physics. But I think the fact that he was swept under the rug, he took it to Niels Bohr, who was the main face on the Mount Rushmore of physics at the time. And, it was kind of naive of my father, because Niels Bohr was if I say, "Okay, you're right," then that's going to knock my face off of Mount Rushmore and put yours on it. So he just dismissed him. And that was it. And I think in a lot of ways that kind of ruined my dad's life. And he just gave up on physics. But he never stopped believing it, But I'm sure he was really hurt and embittered by it.
Mm-hmm. So he died of a heart attack when you were 19. You found his body. On his bed in the bedroom. Was that the first body that you'd seen, the first dead body?
Yes. And it was particularly surreal, since I had this weird relationship with him where he was always there, but, we didn't interact that much. And then just literally the night before he died, we had a a lot more conversation and kind of a fun time together than is normal. And then the next morning I found him dead, and it was very strange because, you know, I'm learning CPR on the phone. And
but you called 911?
Yeah, and then to be touching his body was very strange to me because I don't think we'd ever touched before. And the fact that he was dead while it was happening was just incredibly sad.
Well, as I think you implied earlier, your albums often have at least one song that's kind of like the redemption song, the like, life is good, or at least life can be good.
Yeah. So,
and one of the songs like that on your new album, The Deconstruction, the album starts with you kind of falling apart and starting to put yourself back together. But there's a song on it, Today is the Day. And it's really a kind of song about life, about living, about change, about the possibility of change. Would you say a few words about writing it?
Yeah, I think that really the only way I can really contribute something that can help the world in a maybe tangible way as far as changing anything is a song like Today is the Day. Say you're at a point in your life where you're starting to catch on that there's a change you need to make, whatever it might be, but you haven't gotten around to making it quite yet, and you just happen to hear that song at the right time. It could push someone along, you know, a little bit further along to making the actual change. And I don't get specific about a change in the lyrics, because whatever change I might have been thinking of for myself or whoever I was addressing in the song, you know, if I'd said, today is the day I'm going to stop eating cheese, then that's only going to help people that are lactose intolerant. So I tried to...
But for those people, it could be very important.
Yeah, I try to keep it something that can help us all.
Okay. So let's close with that. Today is the Day from the new Eels album, The Deconstruction. And Mark, it's just been great to talk with you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Mark Oliver Everett is the founder of the band Eels. The new Eels album is called The Deconstruction. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the premiere of the film 2001: A Space Odyssey. It was directed by Stanley Kubrick, who died in 1999. He made many well-known movies, including Dr. Strangelove, A Clockwork Orange, and The Shining. Our critic at large, John Power, says 2001: A Space Odyssey is both one of a kind and an expression of its time.
At the beginning of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, a big black monolith appears in the African desert, leaving a group of prehistoric ape men standing there baffled. That was pretty much the reaction that greeted the film itself. When it premiered 50 years ago, nobody was quite sure what to make of it. The critics were harsh, with Variety dismissively saying, 2001 is not a cinematic landmark. It's hard to imagine being more wrong. You see, even if you don't like the movie, and I don't particularly, the one thing that's undeniable is that it's a cinematic landmark. Not only was it the number one box office movie in 1968, young people flocked to it to have their minds blown, but in international polls, 2001 routinely ranks as one of the top 10 films of all time. An avant-garde art film dressed in Hollywood money, it unknowingly foreshadowed the future of movies as effects-driven blockbusters. I saw it again a few days ago, inspired by Michael Benson's terrific new book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. Though Benson is afflicted with what a friend calls the Stanley Syndrome, he never stops telling you that Kubrick is a genius and a perfectionist. His book is filled with nifty stories. My favorite is when the control freak director asks Lloyds of London if they could insure him, in case NASA spoiled 2001's plot by discovering extraterrestrial life before the movie came out. Watching 2001 again, I was startled anew that in nearly 2.5 hours, there's so little dialogue or dramatic storytelling. The characters barely register. Rather, in an attempt to make what Kubrick called a really good science fiction movie, not something hokey, he and co-writer Clark thought big. Visionary big. They concocted nothing less than a poetic myth of human evolution, a vaulting ambition announced by the music we just heard from Richard Strauss's Thus Spake Zarathustra, which everyone knows, largely because of this movie. Clark and Kubrick carry us from the origins of human beings in those desert apes to the climactic birth of an advanced new life form, a star baby, engendered by extraterrestrials. In between, we follow two astronauts, played by Keir Dallaia and Gary Lockwood, whose journey to Jupiter runs afoul of their ship's supposedly infallible computer, known as HAL, the prototype of countless movie computers to follow. Here, Dallaia's character Dave learns that there may be a sinister side to HAL's artificial intelligence.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Now, like many classics, 2001 isn't always a good movie. Some bits are boring or superfluous, and Kubrick was clearly more fascinated with the film's sleekly designed spaceships than its ideas about human evolution, which are thin and arbitrary. Yet the movie's carried by images you'll never forget. The monolith, the space station's waltzing to Johann Strauss's The Blue Danube, and the long Stargate sequence, a hurricane of lights and images that were once thought trippy. Its effects were all the more amazing because Kubrick had to pull them off without CGI. His example inspired later directors, who felt that he had both upped the technical ante and made science fiction films respectable. They genuflected before Kubrick's courage in refusing to tell a conventional story. Though, of course, they themselves never dared to do that in their own science fiction films like Star Wars, E.T., Blade Runner, and Avatar. The movie tapped into a key aspect of the 60s, the countercultural belief in expanding consciousness. Though Kubrick was vehemently not a drug user, he wanted 2001 to open the doors of perception, to show us a higher level of being. That dream seems like something out of the past in these days of shrinking consciousness, filled with fake news and the hatred of science. Indeed, watching 2001 A Space Odyssey now is like opening a time capsule. And it can bring on a melancholy nostalgia for the era that spawned it. An optimistic time when Walt Disney created Tomorrowland and Americans believed the future was limitless. The Kennedy-esque confidence that we had the strength and ambition to travel the cosmos seems long gone in this era when even getting our roads repaired feels impossible.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. Coming up, we'll hear from actor Dan Stevens. He played Matthew Crawley on Downton Abbey and now stars in the FX series Legion. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, Matthew, you always make everything so black and white.
I think this is black and white. Do you love me enough to spend your life with me? If you don't, then say no.
If you're a fan of the masterpiece series Downton Abbey, you'll recognize the voice of the dashing Matthew Crawley. He was played by our guest Dan Stevens. His roles extend far beyond his three seasons on Downton, which ended with a sudden and dramatic departure. We'll hear about that in a bit. Since Downton, Stevens has played a heroin trafficker, a psychotic killer, the knight Sir Lancelot, and the Beast in the live-action film Beauty and the Beast. He's currently starring in the FX series Legion, a visually inventive drama spun off of the Marvel Comics X-Men series. The second season is just underway. It airs Tuesday nights at 10. In Legion, Stevens plays a young man who's grown up thinking he has schizophrenia since he has regular hallucinations. He eventually learns he has special powers of mental telepathy and can move objects with his mind. Stephen spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, and they began with the opening scene of the series. Stephen's character, David, is in a psychiatric institution. He's being visited on his birthday by his sister Amy, played by Katie Azleton.
So, do they let you throw a little party here, or?
Yeah, they clear out the furniture, we get a DJ.
Really?
No. I do get better drugs, though.
Really?
No. It's just Thursday. My 260th Thursday as a passenger on the cruise ship Mental Health. On the plus side, I have mastered the art of eating with a spoon, so.
You're getting better, though. The voices. You're not seeing things that aren't there.
When can I come home?
Oh, that's... What does your doctor say?
If I tell them I'm sane, they think I'm crazy. And if I say, you know what? You're right, I am crazy, then they up my dosage. So...
Oh, how about I talk to them? I'll tell them you seem better to me.
Time for your meds.
Well, Dan Stevens, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Well, your character, David Heller, is a young man who's spent as much of his life in a mental institution, I guess. You believe you're schizophrenic, you hear voices, you have hallucinations. How did you prepare to play that kind of role?
One of the things that Noah and I were very keen to do was to treat the idea of mental illness with some respect. I think, you know, it's too often... It can be used as a sort of lazy narrative trope to be like, oh, this guy's crazy, and now some crazy stuff is happening. And actually, what the show is trying to do, I think, is really be an experience delivery device and to try and offer up some of what that must feel like to be David and be inside David's head and feel the things he feels, see the things he sees, and hear the things he hears. The sound edit on this show is out of this world. And, you know, and not just a sort of... not to be glib about it. And I discovered some really surprising things, I think, in conversation, particularly with some patients that I was talking to, that, you know, these are very high-functioning people very often. And, you know, yes, they might be medicated, but their experience of the world is fascinating.
We should listen to one clip from season two. It's just underway, and... This is a scene from the first episode, and a little background. The plot can get a little intricate here, but in the first season, we learned that your character, David Heller, is not actually schizophrenic, but someone with these amazing powers of mental telepathy. And we also learned that your mind was sort of partially occupied since you were a kid by an evil presence, a monster that's called the Shadow Monster, or Farouk at times. And he was purged at the end of season one and then occupied someone else. And what we're hearing in this scene is that you've returned to your allies in the fight against this evil force after a year in which you've been away and you don't really have any memory of where you've been. And here you are speaking to some androids who are on your side. And, well, let's listen.
I've been someplace else, and now I'm here. And we're going to find him, the Shadow King, and put a stop to all this.
He is part of you.
What do they know?
Assume everything. Be honest.
Well, we've been together a long time. I can still sense him, still feel him, but right now I think he's hiding from me, so if there's a way you could boost my signal.
We have anticipated this. Mr. Loudermilk has developed a device to help you recover your memories and find Farouk.
Carrie, good. That's good. So when we find him, the Shadow King, what are you going to do?
He will be terminated.
Right, but he's in the body of a friend of mine.
The scientist, Oliver Bird?
Yes, Oliver. Really, he's a good guy. Like him, if that's something you do. Either way, he's a hostage, and we are not going to kill the hostage.
The body must also be destroyed.
And that's our guest Dan Stevens from the first episode of Season 2 of the FX series Legion, which is just underway. It airs Tuesday nights at 10. You know, there are so many scenes in this, which are these strange kind of hallucinogenic journeys. I mean, things will happen, and as an audience member, I'm not sure whether it's reality, a dream, a flashback. And it may not be clear till an episode or two later. And I'm wondering, how much did you as actors know about what was coming?
Very little. I mean, I think that's one of the things the show really encourages in us as performers, is just a great presence of spirit and a readiness and willingness for all. And certainly in the first season, it was a sort of across the board, this actorly need to know what year something was set in. And as somebody who's done a fair amount of, sort of historical dramas and things, you know, that can be very important sometimes. And people get very obsessive about that as part of their research. And Noah refused to answer the question, and there was definitely a sort of 60s feel to a lot of the styling and the design, but he refused to tell us when this was set. And after a while, that concern fell away. We stopped looking up 1963 as, you know, as a reference point, and it had this kind of curious effect that we entered into the world of Legion fully, and once those concerns fell away, we really, you know, got on board for the ride.
Sometimes friends ask what interviews I have coming up, and the best way to describe you is I'm interviewing Matthew Crawley from Downton Abbey. You know, huge hit. The PBS series was a huge hit here in the States.
Yeah.
I got hooked. I watched every episode. Let's hear a clip. This is early in season one, and Downton Abbey is the estate of the Earl of Grantham, who has no male heirs. You play a distant cousin, Matthew Crawley, who would be the heir, and it would make everything swell for the family and the estate if you would marry the eldest daughter, Lady Mary, played by Michelle Dockery. She's a fiery, independent spirit, and there's clearly an attraction, but she kind of doesn't like the fact you don't really lead the life of an aristocrat. You actually work. You have a job. You're a lawyer. And we're going to hear a dinner scene here where everybody in the family wants you two to hit it off, but Mary is kind of taking shots at you, and you're responding. We'll hear a little bit of Maggie Smith chiming in. She's the Earl's mom, and it begins with the Earl of Grantham speaking, played by Hugh Bonneville, and he's speaking to you, Matthew Crawley.
By the way, if ever you want to ride, just let Lynch know and he'll sort it out for you.
Oh, Papa, Cousin Matthew doesn't ride.
I ride.
And do you hunt?
No, I don't hunt.
I dare say there's not much opportunity in Manchester.
Are you a hunting family?
Families like ours are always hunting families.
Not always. Billy Skelton won't have them on his land.
But all the Skeltons are mad.
Do you hunt?
Occasionally. I suppose you're more interested in books than country sports.
I probably am. You'll tell me that's rather unhealthy.
Not unhealthy. Just unusual. Among our kind of people. I've been studying the story of Andromeda. Do you know it?
Why?
Her father was King Cepheus, whose country was being ravaged by storms. And in the end, he decided the only way to appease the gods was to sacrifice his eldest daughter to a hideous sea monster. So they chained her naked to a rock.
Oh, really? Mary, we'll all need our smelling salts in a minute.
But the sea monster didn't get her, did he?
No. Just when it seemed he was the only solution to her father's problems, she was rescued.
By Perseus?
That's right. Perseus, son of a god. Rather more fitting, wouldn't you say?
That depends. I'd have to know more about the princess and the sea monster in question.
Ouch. That's our guest, Dan Stevens, in a scene from Downton Abbey. This is a fun relationship to follow. The series is so much about class relationships around the turn of the century. You grew up in a middle-class family and then went to Tonebridge, which was sort of, you know, a more, I don't know, I guess a different kind of school. Did you feel like you were encountering a different world, a different kind of class environment?
Yeah, I mean, I've been lucky in my life that I've moved around, you know, all different sort of classes and people from all backgrounds, and I've really enjoyed that. You know, England is it's a strange little country, really, and it's a mad collection of islands, the British Isles, and there are some very, very strange ways there. And, you know, the class division is so deeply embedded, and, you know, there is such hideous snobbery. It's something that I think everybody over there has experienced in some way from whatever background they are from. You know, it was a really fun show from that point of view to explore those and to explode some of those things that happen to this day, obviously to a different degree. But there is, yeah, that snobbery is definitely pervasive in that society for sure.
Well, fans of the show will remember what happens at the end of season 3, which I think airs right around Christmas, is you just very suddenly die in a car crash, single car accident at the end.
Yes.
Just describe the reaction. Was it actually Christmas Eve or Christmas Day that this was broadcast?
I think it was Christmas Day. And I think what made it almost more punishing was the fact that the previous season had ended. We did a Christmas special. I don't think the first season had a Christmas special as far as I remember, but the second season, we had this extra episode on Christmas Day, and there'd been this beautiful proposal, you know, the most ultra romantic scene that Downton could produce, you know, Matthew Crawley kneeling in the snow, you know, proposing to Lady Mary, and it was so rosy and golden, and it was just a really lovely Christmas episode, and everyone thought, oh, that's nice. And so the following year, I thought, wow, that's, you know, that seemed to go well. Let's do another Christmas special. But of course, they had to dispatch of Matthew somehow. And I didn't know when they were going to do it in the season. I kept waiting for the script to come in where he was going to, I don't know, go hiking in the Himalayas and, you know, fall off a cliff or something, or, you know, get gored by a stag in the Scottish Highlands. And nothing came. And then this script came in. And so Mary had been pregnant, and the baby was born. And the initial script was the family went to the hospital to visit Mary and baby George, and they were all coming out of the hospital. And I think Matthew was talking to his mother, maybe, or he was talking to somebody, and he had a line like, "I've never been happier in my life." And he stepped off a curb and was hit by a grocery truck. And everybody, so the script came around, I think it was, I can't remember if it was emailed or put in our trailers in a paper form, but simultaneously, everybody grabbed the script, ran back their trailers, read through it, and almost simultaneously, you had people just running out of their trailers saying, "No way! No way!" And there was a sort of mass revolt that this was too much, it was too shocking, and it was insane. And I think had that been the version, it would have upset even more people than the eventual draft, which was only the second version, was that, you know, he was going to be driving away, I think, you know, in his AC, and you know, was clearly gloriously happy and wind blowing in his floppy blonde hair, and then got into an automobile accident instead. But it was only marginally less shocking than the original plan.
Well, so it happens. Everybody's watching. They're feeling great. They're sipping their eggnog or whatever. And then you just, blop, you die. And the reaction was just overwhelming. And a couple of tweets, one person tweeted, "I'm 100% done with this show. I can't breathe." another one, "My mom cried. My cat cried. What the hell? My whole life is ruined." I will admit that I stole those from an episode of the Graham Norton Show, which you appeared on, in which they talked about this. So, how do you react to that?
There's a number of different ways you can react to that. I suppose initially it was upsetting to me that I had upset so many people. I, you know, habitually don't like upsetting people. I don't mind sort of putting people at their unease sometimes and you know, surprising and disturbing people. But if I'm actively making people's grandmothers cry, you know, that's not a great thing. It's not something I'm hugely proud of. But I think... it was just, it's a testament to how much people cared about that character and about that relationship and how invested they were in the show. You know, it's a rare thing that people get so into a character like that. And I guess, you know, I'm sorry. you know, I get guys, particularly guys who want to tell me how upset their wife was, which is usually code for "you made me cry," and I'm not gonna fess up to that. But my wife was very upset.
Well, I think a lot of people probably don't know about you is that you one year became a judge for the Man Booker Prize, which is, you know, England's most respected literary award, for which you read 147 books. Is this right?
Yeah, in 7 months. It's not something I would recommend.
And you have little kids at home doing this.
I did, yeah. In fact, during that year, so it was 2012 that we judged that, and I think we started reading them towards the end of 2011. My wife was pregnant with our second child. I was shooting the third season of Downton. I was producing a movie and, yeah, trying to read 147 books, you know, for the Booker Prize. And, you know, there's a panel of five judges. And, you know, it was myself and four very esteemed literary, you know, people from you know, the English literary scene. There were, you know, professors and critics and, you know, massive brains. And me, just sitting there throwing in my sixpence of what I thought of these books. But it was an honor to be asked and an amazing challenge. I don't know if I would do it again in a hurry, but... I'm really glad that I did it, because it really it changed the way that I think about literature. And you know, just for 1 year, looking at the landscape of literature and what makes great literary fiction, you know, there really are no rules to that prize. You're just looking for the greatest work of literary fiction that year, which, you know, whatever that means, and that means something different to everybody, I think. So trying to reach a consensus on that was an incredible task.
Dan Stevens, thanks so much for speaking with us. It's been fun.
Thank you.
Dan Stevens is now starring in the FX series Legion. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.